Welcome to the Goodness Podcast, the Middle East's first platform dedicated to tackling women's health in a real and honest way. I'm your host, Noor Tahini. My guest on the podcast today is Dalia Halabi, a mental health counselor and holistic therapist with a background in psychology. She's also a certified life coach, NLP practitioner, hypnotherapist, theta healer, and Reiki master, amongst other things. She's joining me to discuss our generation's mental health, specifically as it relates to anxiety. She'll also be sharing practical, applicable advice for dealing with anxiety and panic attacks, so stay tuned. Hi, Dalia.
Hey, Noor.
How are you?
I'm great, thanks.
So does someone like you who has studied all of this stuff and who's studied psychology and NLP, and I mean, your sort of list of accomplishments is quite impressive, but does someone like you still experience anxiety?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I wanted to tell you, like, if you're experiencing this and you're feeling this, you're not alone. Like, so many people experience anxiety on a daily basis. And the one interesting thing is many people who experience the symptoms of anxiety don't even recognize that this is actually anxiety, especially because you feel it it's in such a physical way, but it's actually such a mental process and it can be overwhelming, but we feel it in our body. And it's usually our emotions that we're feeling. And that's why emotions are called feelings too, because we can physically feel them. But I mean, I really believe that it was because I was able to even me experience anxiety a lot. And I know what it feels like to have a panic attack. I understand what it feels like to have that overwhelming physical response to something that you're not very clear on what it is. Like I'll be driving to work. Everything is fine. Nothing is on my mind. And then suddenly I just feel like this overwhelming wave of, I need to stop. And I need to, like, I can't breathe. And the palpitations. It's horrible. It's so horrible. But you said something that is so spot on, because especially now we are living in such an age of uncertainty. And as human beings, we are programmed to need to feel like we're in control. And the minute that is threatened and we feel, actually, I don't have as much control as I think, our brain reacts to it in a way that triggers our fight and flight response, if that makes sense.
So anxiety becomes essentially just added stress on your body and your mind.
We've become so habitually used to living outside ourselves. We're always rushing around from one place to another, and there's always something to do and someone to meet and some place to be, that we are no longer grounded with ourselves. We don't know what it feels like to be in our bodies, and we especially don't know what it feels like to be attuned to the thoughts that we are having. So our brain has like 60,000 thoughts a day. And I bet you not a lot of people are aware of even 2% of what those thoughts are. And it's happening at a both subconscious and a conscious level. And so when you're having these kind of mental processes and your body's reacting to them, yet you're not aware of them, it's not surprising that people will get hit with this wave of anxiety, not understand where it's coming from.
It's funny that you said outside of themselves, because literally this morning my husband was like, how are you feeling? And I was explaining to him how I felt. And I told him, I feel like I am outside of my body. Like, I don't feel in line. And he was like, oh, wow, I know exactly what you mean, but I've never been able to put it in words. I was like, I guess that's how I feel. But one thing that I discovered a few years ago, or not really discovered, but learned a few years ago, was how much our emotions impact us physically. So we think of emotions as something that happens just in our heads, sort of up there, and are not actually physical manifestations. But in fact, not only do these emotions have physical manifestations, but they can also get stored long term in different parts of your body. Correct?
100%. 100%. Yeah, that's true. And this is the foundation of cognitive behavioral therapy. It relies on the model that your thoughts create your emotions, and your emotions are stored in your body. Again, hence why they're called feelings. So, and when we look at emotions, they don't come out of nowhere. They come from thoughts. And especially, for example, if we're talking about anxiety, you have anxious thought distortions. These are cognitive distortions that trigger the feeling of anxiety that results in our body reacting by activating, you know, our triggering the fight and flight response. And like, we'll be sitting at home, lying in bed, doing nothing. Suddenly a thought comes or pops into our head. Maybe we're not even conscious of that thought, but your body, your brain doesn't know the difference between what's real and what isn't. So your brain is going to react in the same way as if this is actually happening now. And so when the fight and flight response is activated and the adrenaline is rushing through your body, getting you ready to either fight or run away, but in reality, you're just sitting and you have nowhere to expend that energy, it starts to feel like, oh, this is, you know, we're feeling anxious. And a lot of these thought distortions, you know, it can look like all or nothing thinking, right? When we only see things in black or white, you know, something's either good or bad. There's no room for middle ground. That can lead to anxiety. Another example is like overgeneralization, which is when you're seeing a constant negative or never-ending pattern as a result of one event. So maybe one bad thing has happened to you. Okay, one bad breakup, all guys are horrible or yeah, men are bad.
Or like one aspect of your life isn't the way you want it, and all of a sudden your whole life seems like it's not going the way you want it.
Exactly, yeah. There's many examples of these types of cognitive distortions that actually lead to us feeling bad. And when we are storing these feelings in our body over time and we're not looking at it and we're not investigating, then that ultimately will result in anxious feelings.
Mm. In your opinion, why do you think we're so anxious? So a colleague of mine and I used to call sort of our generation anxiety, because it feels like so many of us are struggling with this. But I don't know if we're right to say that, because I don't know if previous generations have felt just as anxious or not. I mean, I feel like we might be a little bit more anxious because of the pace of our lives and things like that. And we can talk about the reasons why later. But it just feels like, our generation is particularly prone to this sort of anxiety and detachment from ourselves. Is that what you found as well?
Yes. I mean, it's really interesting because the way that anxiety manifests itself hasn't really changed over the centuries, but the things that trigger our anxiety definitely have changed. So we're no longer worried about the approach of predators, right? Now we're worried about work, money, family, health, and other things that really require our attention, but don't necessarily require the fight or flight reaction, if you know what I mean. I'm happy to delve a little bit more into what these triggers are.
Definitely.
Okay. So one of these triggers and a big pattern that I found is loneliness. When we're experiencing loneliness or we feel separated from the world or we believe others don't accept us, it's kind of crazy to think that this is the generation of loneliness when we're so connected and we're actually more connected than ever before. And there's a difference between being alone and being lonely. For many people, being alone is therapeutic. We need a little time for ourselves. But when we are feeling disconnected or isolated and we feel this kind of loneliness, it causes anxiety because at our core, we're tribal creatures. And evolutionarily speaking, our biggest anxiety was to be separated from the herd, because that obviously exposes us to many dangers. And the same fear still exists in our limbic or our primitive brain. So people with generalized anxiety disorder tend to spend a lot more time alone, especially so they don't have to experience their panic attacks in public. But if you look at a lot of polls and a lot of surveys that have been done, it's showing that more and more people are reporting feelings of loneliness. And if you even see some media headlines, they've called it a loneliness epidemic. So, no, it's actually that big that the majority, especially in developed countries, people are feeling more and more lonely. And other triggers for anxiety can be like the way our relationships are manifesting themselves these days. So you have obviously breakups, divorce, and difficulty finding a partner, especially in this day and age. And there's so much pressure about getting married, and people, especially women over 30, who find themselves single, they start to experience anxiety because they're afraid they may never find someone, or they get pressure from the family or pressure from society. And obviously the so-called biological clock that is always seeming to be ticking away in the background. And one thing that you mentioned that is actually really interesting to talk about is our generation is more aware of their childhood abuse or trauma, which can be a huge factor in anxiety. So our parents' generation, and maybe even the ones before them, seem to just accept that hardship is a normal part of growing up. You know what I mean? And if you look at it, this is the generation that would be less likely to see a therapist or less likely to be open to looking at mental health or discussing how their childhood may have impacted their lives. But our generation is more likely to stop and say, wait, this isn't right. I can feel that something from my past is still gnawing at me and it's still affecting me. And we're more willing to introspect, which is beautiful. The fact that we are brave enough to want to revisit our past. But if we don't have the right tools to help us navigate this in the right way, it can turn into a really negative experience. We can be constantly stuck in looking at our trauma, looking at our past, living in our past, that we're inviting that energy into our present, if that makes sense. So it's like a good and a bad thing. It's amazing that we want to work on ourselves and we are aware and we're more open to talk about mental health and see a therapist, etc. But if we're constantly only obsessing about the trauma of our past, that could definitely play a role in just lingering in the background, causing us more anxiety.
So you mean we never get to the point of processing it if we don't have the right guidance?
Yeah. I mean, some people are intuitive. They're able to disengage. They can see that, okay, this happened to me. I understand my parents maybe didn't know any better. They're doing the best they can with the resources they have, and they can just like process it and move on. But other people, and especially because it's so easy to adopt the victim mentality, you know, it's easy to not take accountability for the things that have happened to us. It's easy to just say, oh, this happened to me. I'm unworthy. Life sucks. I'm just going to forever be unhappy. I don't deserve to be happy. And then just hold on to that and just, you know, hold on to that victim mentality. And these kind of people just, they don't know how to be happy because they don't know who they are if they're not victims. And so it's like, it's a self-prep, it's like you're like constantly repeating the same cycle. You're stuck in the same cycle.
Self-perpetuating.
Yes, thank you.
Yes, it just came back to me. Do you think that the fact that we are more aware or more focused on the sort of impact of our youth or the traumas of our youth or our experiences when we were younger gives them more weight in our lives right now versus our parents? Or do they have equal weight, but we're just more focused on them?
The weight is the same. It is scientific fact. Everything that happens to us from our childhood till now, it plays a role. As a matter of fact, your wiring, your actual psychological wiring becomes complete by the age of 12. Imagine. So like in order to truly understand this, you have to understand how like your subconscious mind works. So when you are born, and some scientists have even said, even as a baby in the womb, you only have subconscious. Your conscious mind is not yet developed. It starts developing when you reach puberty, okay? So everything that's ever happened to us since then gets stored. Our subconscious mind is like a sponge. And it is those beliefs or programming that influence our life on a daily basis. And the best way to explain it is via an example. So if, for example, let's say money is a big issue for why people feel anxious. They're always worried about their financial situation. Let's say when we're kids, let's say I'm 3 years old. I notice my dad is always working. He's always constantly working, trying to make money, trying to make ends meet. And I don't get to see him or spend any time with him. So my subconscious brain, which exists only for my survival. And mind you, there's no conscious filtering yet in place to help me understand, oh, okay, he's going to work, he's making a living, he's trying to make money. No, there's no conscious understanding of that. there's only the subconscious program of, oh, money is evil because money is taking away from me people that I love. So my subconscious brain starts to resent money. Now, when you look at the brain in general, your subconscious mind is 88% of your whole mind. Your conscious mind is only 12%, even in your adulthood. And even though your subconscious brain is 88%, it is 98% more powerful than your conscious mind. So the things that exist in our subconscious brain will always be dictating the reality that we are creating even as adults. So as an adult, my 12% is I want money. Money is good. I need money to make a living. Yet I somehow find myself in a reality where I'm unable to save money. I'm always spending more than I can make. And I'm wondering why, and I'm getting anxious about it. But my subconscious brain, which thinks it's protecting me because it believes money is evil, is literally just doing its job. And so there's this cognitive dissonance. There is a separation between what I believe consciously versus what I believe subconsciously. And when the conscious mind and the subconscious mind are in battle, it will, of course, take an emotional and mental toll on the person who's just trying to understand why their lives looks a certain way. And the answer is always buried in the subconscious. But by definition, we are not conscious of it.
Yeah. And by definition, it sounds like we're more subconscious people than conscious people.
100% we are. Yeah.
I think another thing that I always add to the list of sort of anxiety triggers is the extent to which our attention is being pulled in 50,000 different ways.
Yeah.
There's never been so many demands on our attention, I think, between the insane amount of shows and movies and things that you can watch and all the books that you can read and the social media, which pulls you in 50,000 directions. And there's 50 podcasts you want to listen to each week, but you don't have 50 hours. It really takes a toll on you without you even noticing it, maybe. I don't know if you've experienced that, but that's something I definitely relate to.
Yeah. You know something? The first recognizable social media sites were created in the mid-1990s, right? So most people under the age of 20 will never have lived without the curse of social media. And social media can be a curse. I'm sure you can understand that. You know, this is associated with social anxiety and loneliness that we were talking about more, because even though we are more connected online, we feel more disconnected, especially when we see, you know, curated content of what seems to be like the rich lives of social successes of others. And so these youth or these youngsters or whatever this generation is, they count their social success in terms of metrics, such as the number of friends they have or followers, not the number of genuine like partners or life like friends they have or confidants. And this modern technology has, like you said, introduced an entirely new source of anxiety for the present generation. Because of this 24-hour perpetual connectivity, our need to multitask across a range of different activities and the increasingly emotive news alerts. Oh my God, the doomsday scenario. Every week there's something new. And very soon, and in a lot of places now you have like smart homes, right? So almost every appliance in our house is going to be connected to the internet. And even though it seems less obvious, but a lot of people are anxious and are afraid of identity theft, data hacking, phishing, trolling, all of these modern day computer connectivity that brings with it worrisome hassles, including, and I felt this even myself, crashing hard drives, forgotten password, the frustration of daily transaction. Man, even if we want to call our bank and speak to a person, it becomes harder and harder to speak to another person. We're always talking to technology.
Oh my gosh. I tried to deposit a check in my bank account a few days ago and the machine for some reason swallowed up the check and the security guard at the bank was telling me there's an issue with it. He's like, just call this number. I called the number and had literally the most frustrating 30-minute exchange with a human I've had in a very long time. And I was thinking, I was like, this can't be like the most civilized and advanced version of where we are right now. Like the translation of where we are in the world as a banking system, this can't be it. But yeah, I totally get what you mean. Life is progressing at a very fast speed. And I think we're all just trying to keep up and adapt with the times. But, you know, just to bring it back to social media, I feel like we've been having the same conversation, or I feel like I've been like a broken record for the past, like, at least 3 years, where I felt like something's got to change. This doesn't feel right. This is I don't feel so good with this platform, etc. And I made a change for a while. I left Instagram for a year. Mm. And then I came back with sort of my own boundaries. And I have a private account where I just follow things that bring me absolute joy, like travel photography and recipes, etc. But my question is, if everyone is feeling this way, why aren't we doing anything about it?
Well, the question is everyone aware of how they feel? Mm. Are we conscious of it? Because Touché. we are addicted in a way. Anything that's going to take us out of the moment, anything that's going to prevent us from introspecting, from sitting with, I mean, social media is just another way that we are habitually outside ourselves. And honestly, have you noticed how many people will sit on Instagram scrolling, just the act of scrolling without really looking at the content? Their finger is just used to like that motion of just scrolling past stuff. So and it's really hard to break a habit like that, because what is the alternative? Sit with my own thoughts? No, thank you. I've spent my adulthood trying to escape myself now. Like, and social media is the perfect escape.
Is escaping our thoughts something, or the need to escape our thoughts, something that is unique to our generation? Or have you found that it's not at all? It's just the way that we escape it is unique to us.
I think the way that we escape it is unique, but I don't think we're the first generation to want to escape. I mean, even if we are looking at the previous generations and our parents or whatever, they were in complete denial. They're like literally in complete denial over. And again, look, awareness plays a big role. They probably didn't have the same access to mental health awareness, psychological, you know, awareness of what certain conditions are, how certain things can lead to certain things. Like, there's just no understanding of it. And then there's like the whole stigma and the ego and like the role that our society plays. And even when I was talking to my family, when I first started studying psychology, my own family, which I'd like to think are more open. But when I said, oh, you're just going to what? Spend your life with crazy people? It's like, what? You think that only people with mental health, you know, they're crazy? It has to be either schizophrenia or nothing. You know, there's a middle ground.
Yeah, I think in this region, I very often heard the response to a mental health conversation being like, baladala, what do they say? Yeah, baladala. Or like the other one, which is shiddi li halik.
Shiddi halik.
Yeah. Yeah, I understand 100% why to our parents' generation, we may seem a little bit, I don't want to say spoiled, but maybe a bit extra sometimes, because I don't know what your situation was, but I know that for a lot of the sort of expat families here from Lebanon and Palestine, and you know, our parents were all fleeing war zones, and the main concern, and I think this brings it back to the Maslow pyramid of needs, right? So when you're worried about feeding your family, having a job, having a roof over your head, that's what you focus on. But our generation, who have a roof over their heads, food on their table, a loving home, we sort of graduate to the next level of the pyramid, which is
self-actualization.
Exactly, which moves closer and closer to self-actualization and self-fulfillment. So we have the time and allow for thoughts like, who am I? What's my purpose? Why am I here? Which I think if, like, my dad would probably roll his eyes if I said that to him again.
Look, I just wanted to add something to what you just said. That's a very good point about, you know, the wars and the trauma that our parents actually, especially in our region, especially, I mean, as Lebanese people, for example. And now science has found that trauma is passed down through generations. So when you look at your levels of beliefs or the levels of your programming, you have your core level, which are the things that you experience in your lifetime that, you know, from your own eyes or your own body, you've experienced them. But then you have genetic or historic level trauma. So your DNA is not just encoded with your eye color, your hair color, but actual trauma can be passed down as well. Yeah.
That's insane.
Yeah, I know. And it takes such a, and a lot of times we're not aware of it because we didn't, at least most of us didn't actually experience the war ourselves. But it's not just that, it's the scarcity thinking, it's the financial burdens, it's your fear for your own life. So if someone lived most of their lives, let's say our parents lived most of their lives terrorized, afraid of war, afraid living in constant violence, and afraid for their lives, and that gets passed on to us, and somehow we're always afraid for our lives, but we don't know where it's coming from. Nothing bad happened to us. We never came face to face with death. But that same fear for survival is still ingrained on a cellular level. So, of course, we're going to have anxiety because our brain is thinking that we're always in danger.
Yeah. That's interesting because I was aware of the fact that a lot of more spiritual practitioners did something that is called, what do they call it?
Past life.
Ancestral regression. Healing.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Ancestral, what did you call it? Ancestral regression and ancestral healing.
Yeah.
But I didn't realize that it was something that had been scientifically proven and sort of is becoming more accepted outside of the sort of spiritual realm.
Oh, yeah. And it's so interesting. And I've seen this myself. When you heal something that is a genetic level belief or a historic level, you know, program that's been ingrained in you, because we share DNA and because we share our cells and our cells have energy and memory, when we shift, our family shifts too. The people we share our energy with, they shift as well. And my theory is based on our belief system, we obligate people to act in certain ways because everyone is a mirror and they're reflecting back at you your own subconscious programming. And so once your subconscious programming is different, people will be different with you as well.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the physical manifestation of anxiety, of stress, of various emotions, and where they're stored in our body and how that sort of works.
Well, okay. So anxiety is our body's physical response to fear. Okay. So we have symptoms like a racing heart rate, rapid breathing, sweaty palms. Like these are manifestations of, you know, your body getting ready to do the fight or flight situation.
You know, I've never thought of anxiety as the physical manifestation of a thought. I always thought of it. I always thought it was another, just another like mental process. I didn't realize that it was actually a physical manifestation. That's so interesting.
Oh, absolutely, it is. It is because again, it's the relationship. Your brain controls your body. That's why you hear a lot of people say, "Oh, mind over body," right? And when anxiety is such a self-absorbing process that with a more self-observant approach, we can take extra steps to examine what our anxieties and fears are as if we're watching ourselves from a distance by tracking what is going through our head when we go through an anxiety cycle. When you are conscious of the cognitions or the thoughts that you are having when your anxiety hits, you can kind of pinpoint where you can intervene, where you can change the process. And one way to alter the process is to come up with alternative hypotheses, right? Or more positive, you know, it's all faulty type thinking. And when we correct our faulty thinking, we can decrease our anxiety. Now, just one thing, remember how I said in the beginning, we have 60,000 thoughts a day. And most of the times we're not conscious of those thoughts. And 90% of those thoughts are recycled. This is according to a Cleveland Clinic study. All right. So the same thoughts you had today, probably you had yesterday and the day before and the day before. So imagine eating the same food every day, and that's going to make you sick. So imagine your brain. Now add to that the fact that our brain's tendency is towards the negativity bias. That means our brain's subconscious programming is to focus on the negative because that's what kept us alive. You know, that's what kept our ancestors alive.
We needed an evolutionary process. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. And so when we're feeling anxious, the challenge is really to try to keep our thoughts as reality based as possible. But these thoughts will manifest themselves in our body. So where, okay, a lot, this is like a trivia question. Where do you think we have one or two brains?
Well, they call the gut the second brain, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Where do we feel most of our feelings? In our gut. And
okay.
And our body is so, so intelligent. Like, it's so smart. It's I swear, the more I think of it, it's beautiful. It's so beautiful. But like, for example, in yoga, we talk about this a lot. We store a lot of our emotions, as in like our sadness, our stress, in our hips. And when we have tight hips, we have our lower back starts to hurt. We're not flexible anymore. Where do we store support-related beliefs? Oh, the belief that I'm not supported, the belief that I'm alone in the world, in our skeletal system. Kamen, there's like a very obvious relationship, you know. In our backs, we feel the support issues. If we feel the weight of the world on our shoulders, if we mentally think the weight of the world is on our shoulders, where are we going to feel it? On our neck, on our shoulders. If we feel uncertain and we're not sure what the next step in our life is going to be, you'll start feeling that in your legs. Like, you see, like, it's sometimes such a beautiful but obvious connection between the emotions and your body's response to those emotions.
Yeah. Have you found in your experience that women tend to hold things in their womb? So I've been reading a lot about this, and there's a belief, or like sort of a school of thought that believes that women hold a lot of trauma in their womb. So there are rituals and ceremonies you can do for a sort of womb healing, but also that women's sexuality and sexual energy is very strongly linked to their creativity, their energy, their focus and cognitive abilities, and that in the same way that you said your gut feels certain things and we feel through our gut, these scientists are proposing that the women, actually, you know what, hold on, I took a screenshot of a passage from this book because I thought it was just fascinating. I'm going to, it's on my phone, hold on, I'm going to read it to you. Here you go. Female sexual pleasure, rightly understood, is not just about sexuality or just about pleasure. It serves also as a medium of female self-knowledge and hopefulness, female creativity and courage, female focus and initiative, female bliss and transcendence, and as a medium of sensibility that feels very much like freedom. To understand the vagina property is to realize that it is not only coextensive with the female brain, but is also essentially part of the female soul.
Wow, that's beautiful.
It's from a book called Vagina by Naomi Wolf. I was reading an article that had this excerpt, and I haven't read the book yet. It was pretty controversial when it came out because a lot of people took issue with it. But she says it's based on the latest science, and it's always interesting to read different opinions that are out there. But just to bring it back to my question, have you found this link? Have you found that women are carrying trauma in the womb or in other sexual organs?
Okay, look, that's a really interesting topic. And in order to explain this, we need to just acknowledge that there is something called a collective consciousness. Mm-hmm. Now, the collective consciousness around females and being female and what it means to be a woman tends to be a little negative, isn't it? We go through a lot of not just discrimination, but like, being sexualized or being, you know, put down, or, you know, all the things that we get the shit end of the stick of being women, if that makes sense. That exists in, if you want to visualize it, like a cloud above us. And that cloud stores all these conceptions and misconceptions and beliefs and whatever about women. And we're all connected to that cloud at some subconscious level. And so if they believe this, say, in Africa, I will pick up on it here because it exists in the cloud. And when we're born with this female gene type thing, it's ingrained in us that we are still carrying some of that trauma or some of those beliefs. They still exist in us as well. And Now, what you were saying, our solar plexus, which is the chakra of where the womb is, that is your chakra for creativity. So yes, that is the place of creation. It's the place where not only do we, you know, make and give life to, you know, children, but also our creativity, our life's purpose, everything, it kind of comes from there, from our sacral chakra. But also there's the fact that genetically speaking, look at our ancestors. So you know how we said earlier, you can even have trauma or whatever passed down to you from your ancestors. So just think of the history of what women have been through over the years and what our ancestors must have been through as women and how that is somehow transferred to us at some subconscious level as well. And I don't know exactly if it's stored in the womb. I know that from what I've studied, a lot of sexual abuse, a lot of rejection, that gets stored in the womb. Any kind of, like, for example, a woman with, you know, ovary issues, polycystic ovary, these kind, and sexual abuse is not only the obvious way that we think of sexual abuse. Now, remember, the way we see things as children is different than the way we see things as adults. So the way the brain registers certain things is very different.
Yeah. It's funny you said we feel like we got the short end of the stick. It's so true. You can see it. You can hear it in conversations as well. You know, women will say, we get our periods every month and we have to go through childbirth. What do men have to do? You know, as opposed to seeing it as sort of the life-giving power that we have. It is very interesting. But I wanted to also say that if people are listening to this and thinking, like, what kind of collective cloud is this? Like, it feels a bit woo-woo. In a sense, the more physical, tangible interpretation of that cloud today is sort of the internet, right? We were all plugged into the same apps and the same system, and we are being reminded of it, and rightfully so. It's good for us to be aware of what has happened in the past or what's happening in other places of the world. But every time you open your phone, it's like, you read about, you know, abuse of women in Turkey and an honor killing in Jordan and this and that. Yeah. So even if you don't believe that you are plugged into this more like spiritual cloud, you're totally plugged into a tech cloud that feeds you that very same information. And so it does affect you definitely on some level.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you know something, so just about this, the collective consciousness cloud, they did an experiment in Japan and that's actually how they discovered that there must be something like a collective consciousness. So there is this island off Japan where a specific breed of monkeys exist only in this island. These monkeys, or this type of monkey, I really don't remember what it was, but they only exist on this island. And so they taught, the scientists taught one of the monkeys, only one, not even all of them, how to wash her food or its food before it ate it. Okay. So it would just dip it in the water and then it would eat it. And then soon all of the monkeys on the island started doing the same thing, which is okay. You know, you learn through imitation, but then they found monkeys on other islands, on other sides of the world, even not even just in Japan and other islands around Japan, but monkeys everywhere suddenly, for the first time, started dipping their food in water before they ate it.
It got downloaded from the Matrix.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, I just thought that's a bit mind-blowing. It's so cool.
Yeah. Definitely, there's so much that we don't understand. Ladies, we've heard your feedback and we'll be delivering our podcast to you in shorter 30 or so minute segments. So you've just heard part one of my conversation with Diala on anxiety. And you can tune in a couple of days for part two, where she'll be sharing her tips for how to manage it.